I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. If you live on the East Coast of the United States, you know all about dealing with floods that have become more commonplace. Storms combined with sea level rise have wreaked havoc on a number of coastal communities. Our guest, Rutgers University climate scientist Robert Koppen, and his colleagues have tracked sea level fluctuations and found that global sea levels have increased by about 5.5 inches in the 20th century. That's the fastest increase in the last 28 centuries. We wanted to know more and ask Bob Kopp to join us. He is associate professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences, associate director of Rutgers Energy Institute at Rutgers University, and the lead author of this new paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Temperature-Driven Global Sea Level Variability in the Common Era. Bob Kopp, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be here, Marty.
How do you measure almost 3,000 years of sea level rise and fall?
Well, that's a great question because, of course, we only have direct measurements going back 300 years in the very oldest of locations in Europe and much more recently in most of the world. But using geology, we can construct records of local sea level changes using a variety of techniques, the best of which some work that's been pioneered by people like my colleague Ben Horton at Rutgers and Andy Kemp at Tufts. Involve using salt marshes. So basically, you go to a salt marsh, as you might find, say, on the shore here in New Jersey, and you take a core through the top few feet of sediment. And then you or a grad student sort of goes through the core painstakingly counting the different types of tiny fossils called foraminifera. And these fossils are the foraminifera are sensitive to how saline the water is. So you can figure out where in the tidal zone the sediments were laid down. And so then you know where in the tidal zone the sediments were laid down, you know how deep they are today, and then you can use something like carbon-14 to figure out how old they are. And from these sorts of details, you can construct a record going back a couple millennia that has resolution of a few inches and time resolution of a few decades. And then the trick in this paper is to piece together all of these records from around the world and figure out what the global signal is.
And I'm interested in that global signal. If we're talking about 5.5 inches approximately increase in the 20th century, is that evenly distributed around the world?
Well, that's a good question. No, and so, of course, we talked about global sea level. None of us live at the global average, right? We all experience sea level rise somewhere in particular. And there's a whole range of different factors that cause sea level rise in any particular place to differ from the global mean. For instance, here in New Jersey, we experienced closer to a foot of sea level rise in the 20th century. And a lot of that difference is because the land is sinking, both because of the ongoing effects of the end of the last ice age and because sediments on the shore are compacting under their own weight and accelerated by the fact that we're drawing groundwater out of them.
A foot. I mean, need I say, that's a lot.
It's quite a bit. We, in an earlier paper, we estimated that about 70,000 people were exposed to flooding during Sandy in New York and New Jersey who wouldn't have been had it not been for the sea level rise since 1900 in this area.
Well, and if you're looking at the 20th century, are we looking at the effects of the Industrial Revolution, the effects of the increased use of fossil fuels, for instance?
Yeah, that's one of the conclusions of our paper. If you look at the relationship between temperature and sea level change over the last 2,000 years, which is one of the things we can do with this new 3,000-year record of sea level change we've constructed, we see that if we hadn't experienced global warming in the 20th century, as temperatures had never risen above their average temperatures from 500 to 1800, then we likely would have experienced about a third of the sea level rise we actually experienced. So a majority of 20th century sea level rise is due to us.
Due to us. What's interesting, too, looking back, and I guess this takes us back to the Middle Ages, about the year 1000 to 1400, there was a period of cooling. What does that tell us?
Right. So, of course, the Earth undergoes natural variability. for a variety of reasons, changes in its orbit over several thousand years. So actually, you know, if you look, step back and look at the world at a 6,000-year timescale, the Earth has been very gradually cooling all over that time period. It can undercool faster when you have a lot of volcanic activity, putting particles in the stratosphere. And there's just a variety of different factors. But between 1,000 and 1,400, some of the temperature reconstructions that have been done by people like Michael Mann and Sean Marcotte show about 0.2 of a degree Celsius or 0.4 of a degree Fahrenheit of cooling on the global average. And physics would lead us to think that sea level should be declining when that's happening. And what we can say with this new record is that that's actually what we see. We see about 3 inches of sea level fall associated with this 0.4 of a degree Fahrenheit cooling over the 400-year period from 1,000 to 1,400. And that's one of the keys that help us figure out sort of what the relationship between temperature and sea level has been over the last couple millennia.
Could we say from that if there were more volcanic eruptions, and I'm not saying that's necessarily a good thing, but if there were more things like that, that that could actually cool the planet?
Yeah, well, and you see that if you work at the record in the 20th century. There, you know, there are a few large volcanic events, and those are generally followed by a cooler year. You know, of course, there's all this discussion about geoengineering or solar radiation management that involves, you know, putting particles into the air pollution into the stratosphere in order to make the planet sort of more reflective. And that's essentially a discussion about whether humans should try to play with the energy balance of the planet in a new way and replicate the effects of volcanoes.
And can we take this this information that takes us back almost 3,000 years, can we use that to predict what might happen at the end of this particular century?
Well, we can use it to say what would happen in this century if the sort of same relationship between temperature and sea level continues to hold. And there's reasons to think that might not be the case because ice sheets are playing a very large or growing role in sea level change now, and they probably didn't over this time period. But we can say if the same relationship that's held in the past continues to hold, we would be looking at a likely or very likely sea level rise of about 2 to 4 feet globally if we are on a fossil fuel intensive path, and about 1 to 2 feet if we sort of cut back emissions sharply as sort of the official aspirational goal of the nations of the world.
So what would that mean for someone, let's say, living in Atlantic City or maybe even New York City or some of the cities and communities along the East Coast, for instance?
Well, I mean, it makes a significant difference. One of the key effects of sea level rise is that you think about a storm event or even a tidal event, right? You raise the average level of the sea, you need that much more tide or that much less tide or that much less of a storm to cause the same level of flooding. So what you end up seeing is that at a certain point you see sort of exponential growth in the number of floods. And in many ways, places, you know, with respect to nuisance flooding, what the Weather Service calls a nuisance, it means, like, for instance, you can't get to your house because the road is flooded, not major economic damage. But nuisance flooding in many coastal cities in the U.S. has already sort of entered this sort of exponential growth phase, according to some NOAA work that was published a couple years ago.
Bob, you mentioned the ice sheets in I guess, what we're talking about, Greenland here. Help us understand, I guess, the role that they are playing in sea level rise.
Yeah, so it's Greenland and Antarctica. And actually, it's probably Antarctica we need to be worried the most about simply because the physics there are the most complicated. So why we're concerned about Antarctica in particular is that a lot of Antarctica sits, the Antarctic ice sheet sits below sea level. So it's very vulnerable to interactions with the oceans. And it turns out those interactions are complex, and there's a lot of factors that go into it to those interactions. But, for instance, there's a danger that you might get a runaway marine ice sheet instability, it's called, where you sort of keep eating away at the ice sheet, and then by eating away at the ice sheet, you expose more and more of the edge of the ice sheet to ocean water, and then you basically keep eating away at it until the slope of the underlying surface changes until you no longer have that feedback. And there's been some interesting work being done with the stability of ice cliffs And sort of the role of ice shelves in supporting it. So there's all this sort of relatively complicated physics that we're just starting to figure out, and that means that these ice sheets that sit below sea level are some of the potentially most vulnerable contributors to sea level rise on the planet.
And when we see those dramatic pictures of what looks like almost like a cliff of ice breaking away and falling into the ocean, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, no. Of course, that's going to always happen where you have a ice cliff that's up against the ocean, and you don't have a ice shelf, floating sea ice in between it. But the question is, how large a role is that? And there's some work that my colleague Rob DeCanto up at UMass has been doing, which suggests that this may be a significantly underestimated factor, even in this century and certainly beyond, in terms of the contribution of Antarctica.
Does this study reinforce what we know? Does it tell us something new?
So our study, I think, in many ways, I would put the key finding as, right, physics tells us there should be this relationship between temperature and global mean temperature and global mean sea level, and now we have the geological record to show that what physics has been telling us should be so was actually so and will continue to be so.
Does it tell us that it's then human-caused?
If that relationship that we see in the geological record is any guide, we found that a majority of sea level rise in the 20th century was extremely likely to have been due to warming that's tied to human emissions.
Almost up in a break here, but if let's say we, you know, this is not going to happen, but if we completely halted the human emissions that are causing climate change or global warming, would we see then in the 21st century a halt to not just rising temperatures, but also a halt to rising sea levels?
You'd certainly see a slowdown, but the thing about sea levels, right, the oceans and the ice sheets are big and slow responding systems. So it's sort of like, you know, turning around a giant ship, right? It takes time and the ship responds slowly. So there's still, even if we were to stop emissions today,
right,
there's still sea level rise baked into the system. We didn't do that particular analysis, but if we bring emissions to zero by 2080 or so, our analysis would suggest we're looking at a foot or two of sea level rise. And that's significantly less than 2 to 4 feet if we continue burning fossil fuels. But either way, we both have to sort of reduce our exposure by reducing our emissions, but also prepare to adapt to sort of what we've already baked in.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Robert Cobb, associate professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Rutgers University, where he is associate director of the Rutgers Energy Institute. And he's a lead author on this paper we've been talking about. It's in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, titled Temperature-Driven Global Sea Level Variability in the Common Era. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be talking about a recent Supreme Court decision after this very short break. And then a second guest will be joining us talking about schools and teaching climate change. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Robert Kopp about a paper, actually, in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences looking at sea level rise over the last 28 centuries. Bob, what do you make of the Supreme Court's ruling? This came just a week or so ago, basically blocking the Obama administration's efforts to combat a global warming by regulating emissions from power plants. What do you make of what the Supreme Court did?
Yeah, so Marty, well, let me just preface this by saying, sort of, I'm switching the hat I'm wearing, and this is something when climate scientists start talking about policy, I think that's useful to point out. Half of my research is actually on sort of the relationship between climate science and climate economics and on sort of associated policy analysis, and that's one of the things that the Rutgers Energy Institute does. But I just want to make that demarcation with the sea level paper.
Absolutely.
So, what the Supreme Court did was put a stay on implementation of the Clean Power Plan. So they're not, knocking down the Clean Power Plan. They're sort of putting a hold on its implementation. And, of course, one of the things in the Clean Power Plan, the targets actually don't start coming into effect until the 2020s. So it's sort of a very early stay to put into effect. And so there's not necessarily going to be that much of a gap between the in the implementation as a result of it. And, of course, the Supreme Court, the reason why the EPA did the Clean Power Plan in large part has to do with the fact that in 2007 in Massachusetts versus EPA, the Supreme Court told the EPA to regulate carbon dioxide because it was a pollutant. So it's sort of interesting to look at in this context. The Clean Power Plan is an important part of a portfolio of climate policy initiatives the U.S. is undertaking, and certainly a lot is riding on this. It's not the only one. In fact, over the next 3 or 4 years, perhaps a larger influence on the shape of the U.S. electric grid is going to be had by the budget deal that was reached last year, which included sort of policy certainty on some of the tax credits for solar and wind. So for a long time, those sorts of solar and wind credits have been renewed annually, and now there's a clear path that they're going to follow through to 2020 or 2021. And so that's that's in place. That was a bipartisan budget deal. So that helps a bit. But certainly a lot is riding on the U.S. ability to regulate its greenhouse gas emissions in the electric sector.
And just one final question to you. Some have raised concerns that this could affect the climate agreement that was negotiated in Paris last year. Do you share some of that concern?
I think it's a concern. I think we're quite a far away from the Supreme Court actually sort of going back on what it said in Mass versus EPA and telling the EPA it can't regulate carbon dioxide from power plants. So I think it's a little premature, but certainly if the U.S. isn't able to follow through on the commitment we made to reduce our emissions by 26% to 28% by 2025, that is a problem.
Well, we have to end on that note. Thank you so much for joining us, getting our conversation started here on Radio Times.
Well, thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And that's Robert Kopp, climate scientist at Rutgers University. Well, a recent survey of middle and high school teachers found that most of them spend some time teaching about climate change, and that was the good news. The bad news, according to a recent survey, what was taught did not always conform to the accepted scientific consensus that climate change is caused by human activity. We asked Joshua Rosenau to join us, a programs and policy director at the National Center for Science Education, author of a recent study in Science, Climate Confusion Among U.S. Teachers. And Josh Rosenau, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So how much time do schools spend, based on this new survey or new study that you just did, how much time are schools spending teaching about climate change?
Sorry. We asked teachers, do they spend no time? Do they spend an hour or two, three to 5 hours, so forth? And most of the teachers that we asked, we got responses from about 1,500 teachers in all 50 states. Most of them spend an hour or two on climate change, they said. Of the ones who said that they spent at least some time on it, the average hours was around 4 hours that they were spending, so almost a week of class time.
And that
is less than is probably ideal. It's a big topic. It's something that ought to run through the curriculum, but that's much more than we were expecting to find.
1 to 2 hours in the course of a school year, or 4 hours perhaps max in the course of a school year?
I mean, some of them, one of the options that we offered was up to over 20 hours in the course of a school year, and some people did pick that, especially in dedicated earth science classes, which are not terribly common. But even in middle school and in biology classes, some of the teachers said that they spent that long. So there's a huge variation. There are nationwide, there are 17,000 school districts that all have their own curriculum. each teacher in the classroom has a lot of discretion to make choices about where they put their priorities. So some teachers spend very little time. Some teachers spend a tremendous amount of time.
You were, as I read the report, surprised by this finding, and we'll get, I guess, to the bad news. In an ideal world, how much time, if we can put it that way, how much time do you think should be spent teaching about climate change? And then we'll talk about what is actually taught in the classroom. But time-wise, what would be ideal?
I think 1 or 2 hours is too little. It's something that really ought to be integrated. What's wonderful about climate change as a teaching tool is that it connects to so many other topics. So you can talk about oceans and talk about climate change. You can talk about animals and how they adapt to the temperature that they live in and talk about climate change. You can talk in the physics class or in the chemistry class. You can talk about the underlying mechanisms of climate change. You can talk about human behavior. You can integrate it through. So, I don't think that we've got a number in mind of this is the right number. Anything less than that is too little. But it's something that should be showing up all over the place. And in the total, I think more than 1 or 2 hours is pretty reasonable.
Your report looked at actually what is being taught in the classroom itself. What did you find?
That's where it got a little bit more worrisome, because we were worried that we would do this survey and send out all these letters and ask people to send back, and the response we would get is, oh, yeah, I guess we should be teaching that, but we're not. But a lot of teachers were teaching it, which was great news. The concern is that a substantial fraction of the teachers that we surveyed said that they lent a lot of credence to the idea that there are scientists who think that climate change is not caused by humans, that it's driven by natural forces, which is just not where the science is. 97% of science, of scientists, a comparable fraction of the scientific literature say that climate change is caused principally, or perhaps all of the temperature change that we've seen in the last century is caused by humans. So that teachers are lending credence to the supposing view that we certainly see in political debates, but that is not at this point part of the scientific conversation about climate change, is problematic. Some teachers teach both ideas. We ask them, do you emphasize the consensus that climate change is caused by humans? And we ask them, do you emphasize that many scientists think it's driven by natural forces? And a lot of the teachers said that they did both, which is just going to leave students confused about what the science actually is.
Kind of like the evolution, intelligent design, teaching the controversy as opposed to what is, in a sense, settled science?
Exactly. And it's driven by the politics of it are different. The climate change denial is driven by a political ideology or an economic ideology more so than a religious ideology. But the sort of psychological mechanism there is the same, that this is something that in the public conversation is seen as having two sides, but that scientifically one of them has long ago been rejected as not consistent with everything that we know about the natural world. But teachers, either because they haven't had most, this is a relatively new topic for classrooms.
Right.
A lot of teachers probably have not taken a formal course about climate change. Or if they did, it may have been long enough ago that this is a scientific consensus that has really grown up, certainly in my lifetime and in the lifetime, a lot of teachers were out of school before that consensus solidified. So they may be operating on outdated information. And they're facing pressure at the National Center for Science Education. We get calls routinely from teachers who were sent a packet of climate change denying material in the mail, and they're asking, what do I do about this? Or we hear from teachers or from parents or from teachers who are getting pressure from administrators, from parents to smooth things over by teaching both sides. They'll phrase it that way, as if there were two legitimate scientific sides to the question. And that pressure takes its toll. And just living in a nation where that is divided over the question of the reality of climate change, people pick that up. They watch movies, they read the paper, they listen to talk radio. Not this show, obviously, but there are others out there that that would be spreading misinformation about what the science says. And all of that adds up to a teacher's impression that there's something to debate about climate change. And so they do that in a classroom in a way that they wouldn't do for the cell theory or gravity or other sciences that are as well understood as climate change.
What do the textbooks say? And I realize, you know, this is sort of not an evolving science, but our understanding of it has evolved, I should say, over time. Have the textbook kept up with the science or the scientific consensus?
The textbooks are probably, it's not so much that they have a lot of misinformation in them as that a lot of the textbooks have not caught up with changes in the expectations on teachers. So in the last few years, the last 3 or 4 years, a lot of states have adopted new science standards that put much greater emphasis on teaching climate change. If you went back 10 years ago, most states didn't really have much of a requirement that the teachers cover climate change in any sort of detail. And so if it's on the standards, it's usually not really covered in the textbooks at all, unless the textbook author is really excited about the issue. And so it's not an issue that the textbooks, it's not a problem so much of bad information being there. It's that they have not put the information there that the teachers need, which then if the teachers are facing pressure from other sources, they don't have a textbook to fall back on and say, well, this is what the textbook says, so I'm going to teach that.
But it seems
that's a challenge that they face.
Yeah, no, I mean, it seems to me, the information is out there. And I mean, I'm trying to imagine a teacher that wants to teach some of this science and cares about making sure the information is correct that he or she is giving her students. I mean, you can get access to this information. It may not be in a textbook and it may not be in the education that you got 20 years ago, but it's out there now.
Yeah, there are certainly NASA, EPA, other federal organizations that work on climate change have resources on their websites. There's something called the Clean Network that has vetted online classroom materials on their website that they've sorted and vetted to make sure that they're scientifically accurate. There are certainly resources out there for teachers who are looking for it. But if you just do a Google search for climate change, you're going to find a lot of stuff that's driven by political ideology to reject the science. And a teacher who doesn't have the background, who hasn't been trained recently to have gone to a professional development or have some other way of knowing what the state of the science really is today, there's a lot that can make it seem as if the science is less certain than it is.
And let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Josh Rosenau, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, talking about a study he did that's published in Science, Climate Confusion Among U.S. Teachers. And you can join the conversation, especially if you are a teacher, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Josh, you mentioned some of the information that a teacher might get in the mail. I know there are a number of organizations. The Heartland Institute is one of them. Are these largely organizations funded by fossil fuel companies?
I think that's certainly a lot of the history there. The Heartland Institute in the 90s was funded by the tobacco industry. They've gotten money from fossil fuel industries and other associated groups for a long time. I'm not sure who they're currently funded by. There was a controversy a couple of years back when some of their internal fundraising information was made public unwillingly. And so I think a lot of companies around that time actually backed out of their support for the Heartland Institute. So I'm not sure who's funding them these days, but that's certainly the history there.
I wonder, though, and if there is, 95 to 97% consensus among climate scientists that climate change or global warming is real, it's because of human activity, do you think there's something more that the science community can do to help teachers and perhaps make sure that they get this information?
I think scientists can certainly do more to make sure that the resources that are available for teachers are accurate, and to make sure that the research that they are doing is translating into what teachers are understanding. But I think that the thing we can all do is think about the pressure that teachers are facing in those daily interactions. You know, you see a headline in the paper, you're standing in line at the supermarket, you're talking about Leo DiCaprio's acceptance speech at the Oscars.
Right.
And making sure that teachers are hearing from their neighbors, from their community members, that that people want their kids to understand climate change. Because I think that, you know, that acceptance speech brings home how important it is for everybody to understand climate change. This is not just something that people who want to be earth scientists need to understand. If you want to make a movie, you need to be thinking about climate change. If you want to build a house, if you want almost any decision that people are going to make in the next century, we have to factor climate change into it. That's the world that students in school today are going to live in, no matter what. Whatever policy decisions we make now, as your previous guest was saying, there's a very long, it takes a long time for decisions that we make now to reduce the amount of climate change that we're going to see. So a student graduating from high school today will live in a whole lifetime in a world changed by climate change. Climate change education prepares them for that world. That's really what it's about. And if we give them misinformation now, it's just going to make it harder for them.
And just a quick question before we have to say goodbye to you. What about things like continuing education for teachers, for science teachers, just to keep them up on what is accepted science?
Continuing education is really critical. A lot of states have adopted new science standards in recent years that change the topics that are covered, but also have a different approach to science education, moving away from the idea of let's memorize a bunch of important facts, and to focus really on how do we know what we know about science, about every scientific topic. And that's a different approach than a lot of teachers were trained to use and that previous standards in most states covered. So that sort of continuing education is important in general, just to get people thinking about that new approach, and certainly making sure that people are up to date on a science like climate change, where there are regular advances. And even if you had training before, you need to get caught up.
And Josh, we have to say goodbye to you. Thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Rosenow, stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We've been talking about teachers and scientists and climate change, but what about the general public? Do they think that global warming is real? Does public opinion vary from region to region? Does it vary when it comes to political ideology? We asked Tony Lazarowitz to join us, senior research scientist and director of the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication at the Yale University School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. And Tony Lazarowitz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Great to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. So if 95 to 97% of scientists believe in, not just believe in, but say there's true evidence of climate change, it's caused by human activity, where does the public stand on this?
Yeah, so the public, of course, is not quite as certain about this, and I think it's actually very reflective of what your last guest was talking about in terms of science teachers. Nationally, we find that about 2/3, 67% of Americans believe that global warming is happening, so that's not too bad. But unfortunately, only 53% of Americans understand that it's mostly human-caused. And then most specifically to what your previous guest was talking about, only 1 in 10 Americans, so about 12%, understands that it's more than 90% of climate scientists who are convinced, based upon the evidence, that human-caused global warming is happening. So they do not understand that, in fact, the experts have long ago reached this conclusion that this is a serious and real problem.
Is it because no one believes experts anymore, or that experts haven't communicated this information? Is it the lamestream media that hasn't dealt with this issue in an effective way?
Yeah, funny. So I think it's actually a combination of factors. So three in particular. First of all, I think scientists do bear some responsibility here in that we culturally have not repeated this very simple fact of this scientific consensus. And repetition is critical, especially when you're trying to communicate to 320 million Americans in a very fragmented media landscape. So one, we haven't done a good enough job. But secondly, there's been this longstanding practice within the media of what's called false balance. And essentially, it's what your previous guest was talking about among some science teachers. Well, that's been true of the media as well, is that if the media themselves don't really understand the nature of the consensus, there's been this tendency to say, well, here's a climate scientist, and here's somebody who's often not a climate scientist, but who denies that it's actually real. And you put the two of them side by side on television, and the average American public looks at that and says, well, then it looks 50-50, right?
Sure.
That's not, in fact, accurate at all, because it's actually more like 97-3. Okay. The last, though, is that there's been a massive and very well-funded and very sophisticated disinformation campaign by those interests that are very happy and want to maintain the current status quo. And I'm speaking specifically of the fossil fuel industry, which has a long and very well-documented history of funding organizations that cast doubt on the reality or the human cause or the seriousness of this issue. And then what we've also seen growing very strongly in the United States over the past decade or so is the politics of this, that there are conservative politicians who literally tell their followers that this is a hoax, that this is not a real phenomenon. And that, too, influences a sizable proportion of the American public.
I remember Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma using those exact words. In fact, he brought a snowball, I believe, into the floor of the Senate to make his point. Are you saying that he's winning this argument?
He has won this argument in part among the most radical and strongest proponents in his own base. So I think this is where we have to get clear that there is no single American public. There are many different publics. And in fact, our work has identified what we call the six Americas, that essentially you have one group that at one end of the spectrum is alarmed about climate change. It's about 12 or 13% of Americans, fully convinced it's real, that it's human caused, it's urgent. They strongly support policy action. They're eager to know, what can I do? What can we collectively do? And then at the other end of that group of six is a group we call the dismissive, and that's about 11%. Mm-hmm. And these are people who are firmly convinced it's not happening, not human caused, not serious. And as you just alluded to, most of them are conspiracy theorists. They say it's a hoax. It's scientists making up data. It's a UN plot to take away our sovereignty. It's a get-rich scheme by Al Gore and his friends, and many, many other such kind of conspiracy-laden narratives. And in between there, though, are other groups. We call them the concerned, the cautious, the disengaged, and the doubtful, who don't have these really strong, passionate views about that. And so Senator Inhofe has been very effective at communicating with that dismissive wing, that's about 11%, 12% at that end. And some of the group that we call the doubtful, who, because of political reasons, are kind of inclined to listen to him. But he has not done well with the alarmed, the concerned, the cautious, or the disengaged, who, frankly, don't share those same kinds of extreme views.
I wonder, though, with, for instance, people living on the East Coast, since we're here on the East Coast of the United States, where you see more flooding, you see storms creating more damage, for instance, whether and some of these big storms, some of the drought conditions in parts of this country, parts of the world, whether just the extremes of temperature are getting people to think, I wonder if there's something going on here that might be related to climate change.
Yeah, what a great question. So this is something that we're studying very actively. And the reality is it's complicated. That take those six groups I just talked about. Right. If you're a dismissive, and in fact, Jim Inhofe, as you described, brought a snowball, right? It had snowed in Washington, D.C. in February, because that's never happened before.
Isn't it?
Right. For most of us, that's called winter. But he took the snowball in on the floor of the Senate and said, here's your proof that global warming isn't happening, because it snowed on a day in February in Washington, D.C. That's called motivated reasoning, that these are people who are primed to look for any event that seems to counter the often misunderstanding about what climate change is, and then use that to try to further their own priorly held conclusions. Most people, however, are not like that. And that's where I think you're beginning to see, and I really want to stress it's just beginning, this new recognition of the pattern. Okay, it's not just the single extreme event or the single storm, but it's the pattern. So as has been beautifully said, you know, if something happens once, it's just happenstance. If it happens twice, well, that's a coincidence. If it happens three times, well, that's the beginning of a pattern. And if it happens 4, 5, 12, 20, 27 times of extreme record-breaking weather events, some people are beginning to connect the dots and say, wait a second, something's going wrong with our overall weather system. Could this have something to do with climate change?
I wonder whether the insurance industry will be more persuasive than scientists, raising people's razor, deciding in some instances not to insure people because of some of these climate changes.
And then unfortunately, we're beginning to see that already. Many insurers, for instance, have pulled out hurricane insurance out of Florida and jacked up the rates all along the East Coast in no small part because they see that these storms, when they occur, are becoming more and more extreme. And in fact, here in New England, we've seen extreme rainfall events leading to flooding become much more common over the past several decades. So, yeah, I mean, the insurance industry are the ones left holding the bag and have to pay out when these events happen. And in some cases, they're deciding we're out. Mm. We're not going to take on that risk anymore. And that leaves homeowners, unfortunately, in trouble.
Let me ask you about language. It wasn't so long ago people talked about global warming. Now we say climate change. Do you think moving away from this notion of global warming, while it might be more correct scientifically, it takes the word warming out of the conversation and leaves people a little confused?
Yeah. So that very narrative that you just described is actually a narrative that we don't see a whole lot of evidence for. In other words, climate change and global warming have been used as terms to describe this since the very beginning of this study. In fact, climate change was used as a term before global warming. Ironically, because it's often conservatives who make this argument that we used to call it global warming, now we call it climate change, it's actually conservatives who back in the year 2000, 2001, there was a famous leaked memo by a guy named Frank Luntz to the Bush White House basically telling that Republican president, stop calling it global warming. Use the term climate change, because when you use the word global warming, people are much more worried about that. They see that as much more dangerous and destructive, whereas climate change feels like, you know, you're going down to Florida for the winter. And in fact, the New York Times did an assessment of President Bush's speeches and found that after he got that memo, he dropped the term global warming and only called it climate change. So anyway, the point is that both of these terms are very commonly used throughout public discourse, in science, by the media, and in fact have become the primary terms by which we talk about this.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Anthony Tony Leiserwitz, Senior Research Scientist, Director of the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication at the Yale University School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, talking about how we talk about climate change, global warming. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Matt from, looks like Lafayette Hill to join us. Hi, Matt, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, great subject, very important discussion.
Thank you.
The military and the Department of Interior are already planning for mass migration. So, you know, if they know it, we should know it. But I'm a medical doctor on the National Advisory Board of the Union of Concerned Scientists. And they wrote the climate deception dossiers. Basically, it declares, just like the tobacco companies knew well that smoking caused lung cancer for decades and hid that, the oil industry has known from their own scientists that that oil and the burning of fossil fuels has caused climate change. It's man-made. And they buried that information and, in essence, allowed this to go on for decades unbridled, which has changed our climate, hopefully not irrevocably.
Well, Matt, I appreciate
that. So go to climate change, go to climatedeceptions.ca's or decadesofdeception.org for the information.
Matt, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Tony, you want to add anything to what he just said?
Well, he's landed on one of the key strategies of this disinformation campaign, that basically it took a key strategy, chapter and verse, out of the tobacco wars. So basically the tobacco industry realized that doubt was their product, that as long as they could convince Americans that doctors were still arguing about whether smoking caused cancer or other lung diseases, people would continue to smoke. And so they basically funded an entire operation for decades to continue to confuse people and were able to rake in literally billions of dollars over that time. Unfortunately, the fossil fuel industry basically saw how effective that was and funded very similar efforts to sow this sense of doubt. And as your prior guest has talked about, as the national survey data shows, it's been pretty effective because most Americans still do not understand that the experts who study this day in and day out are convinced that this is actually real and human caused.
Do facts change people's mind? If you give people information based on facts, do people think, oh, okay, maybe I'm wrong about this and I should change my mind?
So we've done a lot of work on that, and we find that, again, it depends on which of those publics you're talking about. But one of the things that we find most interesting is that when you convey that simple fact that 97% of climate scientists are convinced, based upon the evidence, that human-caused global warming is happening, we find that that is actually quite effective at shifting people's own perception of the consensus. They say, wow, I didn't know that. They change their own view of that consensus. And that then has cascading effects. They become more likely to say, well, then I think it's real and I think it's human caused and I'm worried about it and I support policy action. Because most of us are not experts, right? We depend on experts to help guide us through this incredibly complicated world of increasing risk. And so if your perception is the experts haven't yet reached that agreement, many people take a wait and see attitude and say, look, scientists, go off in a room, you figure it out, and when you do, you'll come and tell me, right? Not knowing, of course, that was done decades ago.
Interesting. I'm looking at a bunch of comments here we've got from email and tweets. And what I see, a little bit of a pattern here, just this sense of kind of gloom and doom about this, that even if we accept the science here, can we do anything, for instance, in this century or in the next couple of decades to address the problem of climate change? We began this hour talking about sea level rise, which increased something like 5.5 inches globally in the 20th century, with the possibility of a couple of feet in this century, and the sense that, yeah, it might be here, but what can we do about it?
Oh, my gosh. Well, there is so much we can do about this.
And you have about a minute to tell us all about it. I'm sorry to do that to you.
Well, I'm going to use just a quick metaphor then, because it's like we're traveling down a mountain windy road. We are in the car. Nobody's buckled. The kids are in the back. We're fiddling with the radio, eating a burger, not paying attention to all the warning signs that are going by saying there's twisty, windy, dangerous road up ahead with landslides and boulders. And unfortunately, we're going probably 60, 70 miles an hour. Mm. We cannot avoid this stretch of road. We're going to go through this, okay? And there will be probably bumps and bruises and some serious things that happen along the way. But there's a giant difference between hitting that patch of road at 80 miles an hour versus hitting it at 10 or 15 miles an hour. And that's essentially the choice we have. Do we take our foot off the accelerator? In other words, more and more carbon-based fuels and greenhouse gas emissions, and start applying the brake, which in this case means investing in the clean energy future that almost all Americans support and desire.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. That's Anthony Leiserwitz, Senior Research Scientist, Director of the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication at the Yale University School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Tell us what you think of the show. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.